Everyone, you're listening to Affirmative Reaction here on SiriusXM Progress Channel 127. I'm your host, Jorge Andres Olivares. And you know what? I decided to shoot my shot with John Clarence Stewart because as soon as he came on the screen, I had to tell this man that he was wearing the most beautiful color and everything was already as bright as can be. And it's kind of, it makes sense, especially when you think about now, I don't know John personally. Hopefully after today, we'll be close friends. But something can be said about the presence that John brings, especially on screen. And, you know, we're going to be talking about Zoe's Extraordinary Playlist, in which it's currently on its second season. John plays Simon. And there are a few episodes that we're going to talk about, particularly when it comes to Simon's storyline. You might have seen the first one happen this week. The next one comes on the 9th. And it's something that really gives us a glimpse into what life is like for a lot of us who exist in this world as people of color. Particularly in Simon's case, as a Black man navigating the tech world in San Francisco. And so I'm excited to talk to John about not only these particular stories, the themes that we see in these episodes, but how these themes might be relevant in his life and journey as an actor, as a performer, somebody who's been in a space where diversity has not always been top of mind for a lot of people. So curious to get his take on that and just kind of what life has been like on this really crazy journey he's been on as a creative. So John Clarence Stewart, thank you so much for joining me today to have this conversation.
Oh, thank you for having me. Thank you for the compliment earlier. It made me feel nice. Yeah.
You know, you got to do it, right? You got to do that. Because I think something that I've recognized, and I wonder if this has been the case for you, that like you have to say, people are in such weird spaces right now. And I think being able to provide that moment of joy, to provide that moment of levity, is really helpful and really beneficial in order to like continue on with these crazy days that we've had.
Well, I agree. I agree totally. I think that, I mean, it's the formula of what makes drama palatable and what makes comedy impactful, right? Comedy makes room for the thing that's happening that hurts, right? And a lot of times we don't just, as human beings, we don't just like run to the drama, you know? A lot of times the drama creeps up on us because we're living our lives. And it's specifically in these times where it feels like we're at least these tea kettles that are always on the brink of just all bubbling over. We have to have that release. And I think that comedy is that release valve, which is really nice.
I like that. See, now I can already tell, and I mentioned this before we got started, that that's the Southern in you. That's the Georgian in you. Like, I feel like this ability to be open to life and open to kind of everything how you just described life being, I feel like that's very specific to those of us who grew up in the South.
Those of us, you grew up in the South.
I grew up in Texas, and I'm definitely that person who considers Texas the South. I know not many people do. Texas is the South. I say y'all like anybody else. So I feel like it's something that's so specific to that region, that just lifestyle that we were accustomed to.
I can only speak to that experience. I think that I think some of it has to do with a rhythm. Some of it has to do with a rhythm and a pace and a time that there takes to consume, but to metabolize the world around us. Like actually taking in things, even like from that to speech being a little slower, like cadence being a little slower. And I think that it's beautiful. It's a beautiful part of growing up in the South. And also there's this, I don't know if you do this because we're just meeting, but I know for me a lot of times because it's meeting, but like there's this, I speak in pictures a lot. And I think that a lot of that has roots in Southern life as well. This idea of like, this idea of always or very frequently finding a metaphor for or finding a picture that gets you as close to the water as you can with the interpretation taking you to drink, right? You know what I'm saying? Yeah.
I love that you mentioned this idea of the rhythm and cadence that comes with the life that we've grown up in, the only life that we know. But yeah. It kind of makes sense then that you would decide to pursue this life of performance, this life of dance, theater, all the above, singing. Like, would you say that was like the natural transition because of how you experience life?
You know what? Oddly, no. I think, like, for me, I grew up in the church, right? I grew up in the church. My dad was a pastor. My mom, you know, led worship and all of this. So my first experience of dance, like my first experience of dance was watching my mom lead worship, and she would do these interpretive dances up and down the aisles. And she would have the little ribbons and she would do stuff like that. And I always felt very drawn, but I never did it in public. I would always, like, you know, I would only dance in my room by myself. And we were very, 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 very rigid Christians at the time. That was the entire way I grew up. So we didn't listen to any music that was secular. We didn't watch any TV. We only watched these little VHS Bible tapes with these little cartoons. And these, like, little VHS Bible cartoons had, like, a moose or something on it, and they would tell you Bible stories. And that was our fun, right? And I would go into my room sometimes and play these worship songs by myself and, like, dance when no one else was there. And that was my introduction to, like, expressing in that way. And a lot of times when I would dance, it would be with this intent of worshiping, right? In this intent of trying to contact something outside of myself. But that never crossed the threshold of my room. All of that only stayed in that special space. And when I found theater, it was very out of nowhere. A friend of mine was going to an audition at my last semester in high school, and I followed him because I didn't have anything to do. Because when you're a very sheltered kid in the South, and you don't have, you know, friendships or whatever, you just happen to hang around. So I did, and I went to the audition, and the teacher, Coop, was like, "Yo." She didn't say, "Yo," this is my translation, of course.
paraphrasing.
Yeah. Adding. But Coop was like, "You, and of course, do you sing?" I was like, "No." She was like, "Okay." And then a lot of other people sang and did stuff. And then she came back and she was like, "You sure you don't sing?" And I was like, "Don't do it." She was like, "Do you know Happy Birthday?" And I was like, "Yes, just sing Happy Birthday. Everybody close, just sing Happy Birthday." And I sang Happy Birthday. And she was like, "I'm going to put you in the show." So she put me in the show. And that was the beginning of me on a stage with text and things outside of myself and interpreting things. There's been this, I feel like, progression throughout my career of different parts of my artistry being called upon to tell story. And now I just consider, I'm an artist. And I tell stories in various ways. And in Zoe's, I'm fortunate to be able to use song, dance, and acting as the tools to tell the story. And it's always a learning process. Like when I booked Zoe, bro, it was like, I didn't know what I was going to have to do, really. I got the Jane Levy and I, we worked on a show, What If, together. And we were all hanging out, a lot of the cast, we were hanging out in this gentleman's summer. And Jane were talking, and Jane said they were looking for a Black actor, the romantic lead and that sings. And Summer looked at me and was like, "John, you sing, don't you?" And I was like, "Yeah." "Yeah." He's like, "Yeah." I was like, "Yeah." She was like, "Cool." And she typed something in her phone. And the next day she said she put my name in the hat. And then I read the script. And when I read the script, I cried. And I make a lot of my decisions artistically based on the gut, based on what my soul tells me to do. It's the most important compass that I have. And so when I read it, I lost my father when I was 19. And so, like, Simon losing his father and being in the middle of that, called to an experience that is very ingrained in my bones, and being a Black man going through the process of grief and grieving that vulnerable space, that space of, that's when given circumstances forced me and forced Simon to tap into emotions that he's separated himself from. You know, I like to think of it as what things have I had to sacrifice on the altar of, like, manhood or masculinity? What parts of myself had I have had to give up? And softness is usually one of those things. Softness, vulnerability, any acknowledgement of emotions other than like three. And witnessing Simon moving through that compelled me. And then the structure of the story, the fact that we got to hear these heart songs, drew me in even more. And I remember going in to the audition, I was talking to friends, and I was like, they probably want some musical theater type thing, Brad. Like, that's not my dealio. I don't want to do that. They're like, what do you want to sing? And I was like, I just want to sing stuff that I believe in. I just want to sing songs with lyrics that make me feel something. And I did that. And when I did that, you know, things happened the way they did. And I was like, oh, this is crazy. I called my mom after each audition and I told her, I think I did Pops Proud. She was like, yeah. I was like, yeah, I think I did Pops Proud. It's probably not going to happen, but I think I did Pops Proud. She was like, baby, that's all we can do. And I was like, all right, cool. And then it happened. And I was at this table with these brilliant artists, just incredible at what they do. Now that I look back at my life, I find again and again that for whatever reason, and I do believe in the universe, I believe that like what's for you won't pass you by. And we live these lives that where the doors that open a lot of times have always been unexpected. And it's always been I've always been in the space of, do I walk through it or do I not? And usually when I walk through, I don't know if I'm gonna sink or swim. Usually I'm in a space with brilliant people who I don't see myself as worthy with. Usually I'm in that position. And again and again, the process is one of becoming. It's like I go into each space as a caterpillar and I come out a butterfly. And like finding it in myself and going, I don't know. And being like, you gotta do it. Show up and do your best. Show up, did my best, and my best turned out to be exactly what it needed to be.
But so I feel yeah. Like you don't even just show up, like you completely throw yourself into it. And I say that in the most positive way because like, especially in these most recent episodes. So season 2 is currently airing and we just saw episode 5, episode 6 coming up this coming week. And even in those particular numbers in which you perform, there's this beautiful Nina Simone song you sing at the end of this most recent episode. And the way that you just throw your body around to the music kind of just shows where you stand in all this. Like you are allowing your body to be the vessel to have this communication, to have this spirit, to have whatever it is that's operating around you, kind of take you and Simon to the places it needs to go. And I think it's incredibly evident. And especially because the heavy theme that we're exploring in these two episodes, I kind of alluded to it at the beginning, like this idea of, we are now in this place, hopefully, where people are more aware about lived experiences that are different than their own. But unfortunately, it still falls to us as quote unquote marginalized folks to do a lot of the education, to do a lot of the handholding. So without giving away too much, talk a little bit about kind of your understanding of this particular storyline and whether there was any sort of hesitation to kind of go all out with it.
When I got news that I was talking to my showrunner, Austin, he hit me up back in June, July, and they were talking about this and told me this was what they were thinking about. And my immediate response is like, I don't want to do it halfway. I can't be a part of that. There's an immense responsibility. I believe in the power of stories. Like I believe in the power of narrative. So it's important to me. And there was this weight that I felt specifically at that time, you know, we're in the middle of George Floyd had just been killed. And I was processing at that point, all of the microaggressions, I call it like the 1,000 shocks that the flesh is heir to, all of those microaggressions that I'd incurred over the years. It was like, I was in this space where there was nowhere to run. And I just felt the impact of the 1,000 natural shocks in a way that I hadn't allowed myself before. So there's this immense amount of like trauma that I was moving through and am moving through and doing these breathing exercises and stuff to try to calm my nervous system and all of these different things. And in the middle of that, realizing that I would be going into work on this episode and the responsibility that I felt towards it. And also this understanding that, you know, usually on sets, there aren't many Black bodies. And so like to be in this space of wanting to tell an authentic to tell this as authentically as possible in this space, to be honest, and then to know that I was going to be doing that in a space where there weren't many people that looked like me. It made me afraid, honestly. I'm going to do it, right? It's what I'm called to do. And I'm going to do it. I'm going to thrust my body into that space to do the thing. It's like doing that and not being numb to what's actually happening. Doing that with a full awareness of what's happening around me, what's happening inside of me. So as opposed to being numb to the 1,000 natural shocks, to move into a space and go like, I may incur some while I'm doing this and I'm not numb. And so that's going to be an experience. Fortunately, with our showrunner, with Zora, our writer, with even Mandy, who brought in Luther Brown as a choreographer for this episode, and he even consulted on the Nina Simone number as well. He brought Black bodies into the space. And I think that for me, that was essential. It was essential for my safety as a Black person, as a Black body. It was essential to be affirmed as the authority on my experience. So it wasn't just my voice saying, this is what I feel. It's when there's more than one, specifically in the circumstances we're living in now, where because we've been in pandemic times, I say the blind spots that white people have had, and that we all have blind spots in our ways, but specifically racial, these blind spots have been challenged because there hasn't been the escape. They've been a captive audience to these things. They've been a captive audience to death. They've been a captive audience to their friends and their family, their Black and brown friends, moving through all of this and then having to reckon with themselves and how they fit into the puzzle. And so I think that as the blind spots shift, any hardening gets softer. And I've found, at least with this episode, that there is a porousness with the white people in the space that was essential. I know, you know, based on my conversations with Zora, a writer, that Austin had to, I mean, it's not easy to take this story to network, to studio, and to say, this is the thing that we want to do. This is how we want to do it. In this space, like, there were conversations that had to be had. There were lines in the sand that he had to draw. And it's like, this is what we're going to do. This is how we're going to do it. And yes, there's give and take and there's compromise and there's collaboration and all of this stuff. There is the conversation that happens with white bodies in space. Black bodies are not present. You only see the ramification of that. You only see the fruit of that when you get the script, when you see what's written. Unless you are the decision maker, per se, unless you are that person, there's conversations that are had that you're not privy to. So I'm really proud of where we got to. I'm really proud of what we created. One of the things that's most important to me is that we realize that it's labor. It's labor. It's not, it wasn't for anyone involved. It was not a cakewalk. Like, deciding to take on systemic racism in the workplace and deciding to tell it with as much specificity as we can as storytellers means, in my opinion, confronting oneself, everybody involved, top down, confronting oneself. And that process, whatever, like what comes up in a white bodies and Black bodies, what comes up, that's the sinew that brings the thing together. That's it. You can't make the truth without that.
The thing that I find so fascinating is, and it's obviously explored in these two episodes, again, the next one that's coming on the 9th, this idea of the plight of the one, when you're the one Black guy in the room, when you're the one Mexican guy in the room, when you're the one queer person in the room, when you're the one woman in the room, and in trying to get other people to empathize and understand what the feeling is of being the one. And I think that there's such a beautiful exploration of that in this episode, particularly when it comes to you and the other characters of color, and you and Zoe, and how there is this conversation of, I don't need you to be colorblind. I need you to see that I'm Black. I need you to see that I'm different. I need you to see that I'm not like you. And whatever experience you may have that you think is comparable really isn't.
Absolutely. And I think it was, I love that you said that. Any Black or brown body that's been in white spaces, predominantly white spaces, has experienced this phenomena. And I have experienced this phenomena when there's this whitewashing of self and this understanding, this unspoken a lot of times, but then joked around, like the jokes make the cage and you realize, oh, okay, this is what I'm supposed to stay in between. Okay, these are my parameters. And then the complete washing out of any of the color, any of the Black or brownness they mm-hmm. bring. And then the subtle acceptance or repulsion to those Black or brown parts when they do show up in space. If it's, you know, if you're seen as angry, if you're seen as having an attitude, if you're seen as like being difficult or whatever that is, these ways that we learn to survive in spaces like that. But then I think, like you said, the beauty in this episode is specifically with, you know, having a character like Zoe that we're following, is that we get to see this white woman who is not absolved from struggle, right? She's had her struggles. She's had mm-hmm. her things that she's worked through. She's earned her right to be in the space that she's in. No one can take that away from her. But in this scene that we're talking about, this way of, with all the intent of trying to relate, relating with the best thing that she has, and then hearing from someone that she trusts that is not the same. That this is an experience, being Black or brown in any space, is an experience you can read about, you can hypothesize about, you can get as close to the nerve as you can in all of these different ways, but you don't know it. You can't understand it. The best thing you can do is believe me when I tell you that this is what it is. And to believe me when I tell you that this hurts, I think it's incredibly powerful. And I even think of Tobin and his arc of, you know, being first gen and blending into spaces and or being washed out in spaces, and the choice of blending in, the choice of not causing a fuss, the choice of, you know, go along to get along until you get yours, you know, and the ramifications of that, how we as Black and brown people in spaces that are predominantly white, how in a lot of ways it's structured so that we become islands in spaces. And we just see these islands rotating around one another, and the myth that we are solely and totally alone, that it reminds me of, you know, it reminds me of, this is going to be extreme.
I'm here for it.
And I wonder if I can make this correlation in the right way, but I think that it reminds me of people who were enslaved, or like the Jim Crow era of civil rights, where there are these strategic myths created to divide people who are the same. And then like those seminal myths, and how those seminal myths are still roots and branches that we grow from these today. These myths of being a model minority, these myths of, you know, being light as opposed to darker, these myths of if I dress this way and not that way, these myths of all of these things that make me exceptional, and by exceptional, I mean close to white as can be. Mm-hmm. Like all of these myths that we take and we ingest, that become the goalposts that we're striving for when we move into these spaces. That if we're not reflexively interrogating ourselves, like we have this anti-Black, anti-brown mythology and this idea that is impacting not only us, but everyone around us. And so like the responsibility of being one in space, but showing up whole. Like if I can be one in space and show up whole, I take up space. And if I take up space and you take up space, they were no longer islands, were land. Yeah.
God, that's such a beautiful imagery. And I feel like, and unfortunately that's, because I know you have to run, that's kind of where we have to leave this. But I love that my island was next to your island, and we were able to have this like really cool, just wonderful reflection about kind of what it's like to have been the one. And so I'm just really excited to be able to tell our listeners, please be sure to watch, if you haven't already, watch the most recent episode of Zoe's Extraordinary Playlist, and watch all of them because it's currently in its second season. But also stay tuned for this upcoming one on February 9th because you'll understand the complexities of Simon's storyline and how, you know, John Clarence has to be able to navigate those murky waters. But at the end of the day, how, when we have support, when we have love, when we have guidance to be able to make these right decisions, then that all becomes the case. But thank you so much for spending some time with me and
going
as deep as we did.
Absolutely, man. Absolutely. I say, you know, why not dive? If we're going to dive, go to the bottom. Yeah.
I just need to write down all these little gems that I'm getting from you. Like, put it on a t-shirt. I'm going to sell merch. Might send you your commission. I don't know. I might have to.